J.R. Tate, Anita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning, and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamara Tate, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nina Lubin. And we're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX 1460 AM and our very talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell, and today's intern, Jack. So, how are you doing this morning, Nina?
Hi, Tamar. I am enjoying this early spring warmth and the newly lit mornings that we have. And for our listeners, if you haven't heard yet, apparently the Senate has voted to make daylight savings time permanent. Now the bill is on its way to the House, and we shall see.
Love that. Love those long days. I'm seeing some beautiful sunsets, and I'm excited about that, having more daylight, the good thing. So our show today is in recognition of Women's History Month, which is an occasion to commemorate and celebrate the indispensable role of women throughout American history. Throughout our history, despite hardship, exclusion, and discrimination, women have strived and sacrificed for equity and equality in communities across our country. Despite the progress being made, women and girls, especially women and girls of color, still face systematic barriers to full participation and wider gaps in opportunity and equality. The Ballot Box's guest today, Emily Martin of the National Women's Law Center, is going to discuss the fight for gender justice in the courts, in public policy, and in our society, and the issues that are central to the lives of women and girls.
Yes, thanks, Tamar. Absolutely right. So, if you visit the website of the National Women's Law Center at nwlc.org, you will be impressed. The NWLC website has amassed a stunning amount of factual information about the condition of women in these here United States. Information about health care, child care, income security, wage gaps, harassment, just to name a few of the areas covered. Information is presented state by state by state for easy comparison and contrast. And there will be more details about this organization to follow. Our guest this morning is one of the individuals responsible for compiling this information and helping us make sense of it. Emily Martin is the NWLC's Vice President for Education and Workplace Justice. She oversees advocacy, policy, and education to ensure fair treatment and equal opportunity for women and girls at work and in school, with a special focus on the obstacles that confront women and girls of color and women in low-wage jobs. Prior to joining the National Women's Law Center, her passion for gender justice saw Ms. Martin spearheading litigation, policy, and education at the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as serving as president of the Fair Housing Justice Center in New York City. Ms. Martin is a graduate of the University of Virginia and law and Yale Law School. Emily Martin, thank you for your time this morning, and welcome to the Ballot Box.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be in conversation with you both.
Thank you. Before we dive into your areas of expertise at the National Women's Law Center, namely education and workplace gender justice, please, please give us an overview of the center, its mission, its organization.
So the National Women's Law Center has been around for 50 years. This is our anniversary this year. We are a Washington, D.C.-based organization. We like to say that we use the law in all its forms to fight for gender justice, for equal opportunity for women and girls. So that means we do policy work, advocating in Congress, with state legislatures, with the administration to for policies that make a real difference in the lives of women and girls. It means we work in the courts, we represent clients, we litigate, and we try to help shift the culture to a place where women and girls are given the fair treatment that we deserve. We focus on issues including workplace justice and education, which are the programs that I head up, as well as health and reproductive rights, income security and child care, and a lot more. And it's an exciting time to work at the center, for sure. There's a lot to do.
Go ahead, Tamar. Nina, you were mentioning how wonderful the website is, and I fully agree. It's amazing how much is on there. I'm wondering, what are the different ways that all that research that you have on your website, all the results of that research become policy? How does that translate into action?
Well, when we do research, when we release analyses, for example, about the gender wage gap, what we try to do with that research is to make a compelling case for lawmakers about the problem that it reveals and the solutions that it suggests. So just to take one very recent example, yesterday was Equal Pay Day. We were really excited that on Equal Pay Day, President Biden announced that the federal government was going to be taking various steps to reduce the reliance on salary history in pay setting. So to try to ensure that the federal government and the federal contractors don't set people's pay based on how much they were paid in their last job, because when you do that, pay discrimination can follow you from job to job to job through your career. And that was a policy, is a policy, that we've been arguing for a while now, and part of that is showing how women of color especially, tend to be paid less than men in the same occupations. So when you base salary on salary history, those gaps tend to be magnified over time. Part of it was telling the story of states that have adopted this reform over the past 5 or 6 years, and a lot of states have prohibited employers from relying on salary history and pay setting. And we are seeing data from some of those states showing that it's making a difference, that it means that women and people of color are making higher salaries when they change jobs than they are in the neighboring state that doesn't have that policy. So it's an example of the way that we try to use data both to tell the story of the problem in the world and how it shows up and what it means for women and the families who depend on women's paychecks, as well as what we know about how solutions can really change things on the ground.
Terrific example of one of the center's societal impacts. We are going to move into your specialty area in a minute, but before leaving this overview of the NWLC's work, Tamar, I want to note that the data that is available on this website is exhaustive. It's enormous, but searching for it is not at all exhausting. There's a very user-friendly search feature that allows you to specify the issue of your concern, the state or states you're interested in, and the content that you're seeking. For example, I can search for the center's analyses or fact sheets or legislative testimony or a dozen other types of content on, let's say, the wage gap in, let's say, Virginia during, let's say, the prior week or the previous year. The website as a whole is a tremendous resource. So thank you, Emily, for being a part of that.
Well, that is great feedback. I share no credit for the website being easy to use, but we just revamped it in the past month, so I will definitely pass it on to our website
Please
team
do.
That it is getting praise, so thank you.
Please do. And really, for any listener that is interested in just a slice or many slices.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back to the Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate, together with with Amina Lubin. We are speaking with Emily Martin, Vice President for Education and Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. So, Emily, before the break, we had touched briefly on one of the areas of your expertise, which is education and workplace gender justice. Let's start with workplace wages, which we had discussed a little bit before the break. The U.S. has had a federal Equal Pay Act on the books since the 1960s, and most states have similar laws, as you pointed out. What's the current status in a nutshell?
Well, they are important laws that provide important protections, but in general, the Federal Equal Pay Act and a lot of the state laws are in need of a little updating. You know, over the past 50 years, courts have in some ways opened loopholes in the law, and in other ways we've just learned more about what's effective in closing the gender wage gap. So one of the policy initiatives that the Law Center has worked on for longer than I care to recount is the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is a bill that has almost passed Congress several times but hasn't made it, that would really strengthen the Equal Pay Act. It would, among other things, it would ensure that employers can't retaliate against you for talking to your coworkers about how much you make. It would prohibit reliance on salary history, which we talked about a little bit before. It would make it easier for employees to come together as a group to challenge pay discrimination, taking away some of the obstacles that courts have placed in those collective actions. It would require that if employers are paying women less than men for the same job, that they better have a reason that is actually job-related and is motivated by a business necessity. That is a thing that courts haven't always held as necessary. Sometimes they say, well, as long as there's a reason, it's not our business to look and see what's a good reason, as long as it's not just based on sex. So those are some of the things that we've been pushing for in the Paycheck Fairness Act. We've also been pushing for greater salary transparency. One of the problems with addressing pay discrimination is you often don't know you're experiencing it because of this culture of secrecy around pay. And so part of the solution is, as I mentioned, making sure employers can't fire you or discipline you for talking to your coworkers about your pay. But we've also been exploring more affirmative pay transparency measures. So, for example, several states over the past few years have adopted laws that require employers to post salary ranges when they're posting a job announcement. New York City just adopted this provision as well. And that's really important for giving employees more information that allows them to get a better sense of where they fall within the organization, that gives employees more power to negotiate, and that really just shines some sunlight on the pay structures that can really smuggle in race and gender disparities if nobody's looking.
I mean, I'm curious, have there been any COVID-related impacts on this issue?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, yesterday was Equal Pay Day, and Equal Pay Day measures the point into this year that women have to work to make as much as men made the previous year. And we get to that calculation by looking at the wage gap number. Our wage gap numbers, our most recent wage gap numbers, are from 2020. And those numbers showed that in 2020, women working full-time year-round made about 83 cents for every dollar men working full-time year-round made. And that was a slight narrowing of about a penny. But the problem with looking at that 2020 data is there was a lot of problems for women who wanted to work full-time year-round in 2020. Women and men lost jobs as the pandemic hit, were pushed out of work, but women suffered the majority of those job losses and left the workforce at incredibly high levels and are still recovering from that. So we know that women, and particularly women in low-paid jobs, have really borne the brunt of disruptions in the job market from COVID, that more than a million fewer women are in the labor force today than were in the labor force in February 2020. That means that many of these women who have been out of work for long periods of time, that shows up in your wages when you go back to work. And so one of our concerns is the gendered disruptions in the job market that COVID has perpetuated may well show up as wage gaps going forward, because women, especially black women and Latinas, were especially likely to lose jobs or to be out of the labor force for a period as a result of COVID. And when you look at that 2020 data and look at all workers, not just workers who worked full-time year-round, you see that women were paid about 73 cents for every dollar men were paid, so a much bigger gap than that 83-cent number.
And you see many women embracing flexible working now, which is, it seems to be a good thing, but there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning saying that economists are saying it actually could hinder their careers, because they've got less visibility in the office, less face time, so to speak.
You know, there are a lot of choices that we're making in terms of policy, both as lawmakers and also as employers are making choices about what the world looks like going forward. And this is really a moment to ensure that we're thinking about gender equity as we make those decisions.
Okay, we will explore that further after the break. Thank you so much.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, this is Nita Lubin. Welcome back to The Ballot Box. Tamar and I are here with Emily Martin from the National Women's Law Center, and we've just had a discussion about equal pay, gender equity in pay. I'd like to ask Emily about two other pieces of federal legislation that are out there moving around that have to do not with pay so much as with scheduling and part-time workers. The two acts are the Schedules That Work Act. I wonder how many of you out there are like me. Yes, yes, yes. The Schedules That Work Act and the Part-Time Worker Bill of Rights Act. Emily, could you comment on the content of these bills?
Yes, these are two bills in Congress that the National Women's Law Center has been very involved with. The Schedules That Work Act is really meant to address the unstable, unpredictable schedules that have really become more common in jobs like retail, in jobs like restaurants, where often you don't know whether you're going to be working that day until the day before or even that morning. Many employers have call-in shifts where you have to call that morning to find out whether you need to show up at work or not, which means you have to have the day available, whether or not you're actually getting any hours and getting any pay that day. So the Schedules That Work Act would require employers in the industries that have the most unstable schedules, retail, restaurants, cleaning, to provide 2 weeks' notice of schedules. And then if there is a last-minute shift, to have predictability pay for the employees who were affected by that. If your hours are different hours but the same number of hours, you'll get an extra hour of pay. If you were supposed to work a shift and it gets taken off the calendar at the last minute, you would get half pay for that shift. So it just really is meant to provide some stability in the lives of workers. And this is especially important for women workers, who are the majority of workers in these unstable jobs, and who also are often balancing family caregiving responsibilities. It's really hard to do that when you don't know when you're going to be working or not. So we really see this as a workers' rights issue and a gender justice issue. The Part-Time Worker Bill of Rights is also really important to women workers because, of course, women are the great majority of part-time workers. And what it would do is require employers to pay part-time workers at the same rate as full-time workers, so basically the same hourly wage for part-time work and full-time work. It would require employers to allow part-time workers to accrue benefits at the same rate as full-time workers. So no rules saying that you have to be full-time in order to get paid time off, for example. And so that is really important because women are the ones who are most likely to work part-time, to feel like they have to work part-time because of family responsibilities. One other thing that the Part-Time Workers Bill of Rights would do is address the problem that a lot of part-time workers have, where they want more hours, they want to be full-time. It would ensure that employers offer available hours of work to part-time workers before hiring new workers. So try to address the problem of employers having a huge list of people who work part-time, but none of those workers get enough hours to actually make a living. So we are really hopeful that, especially coming out of the pandemic, that the public is understanding more the need for stability and predictability and decent wages for workers at all sorts of jobs, including the need for jobs that you can do while also caring for your family. And schedule stability and part-time worker rights is part of the solution to that problem.
Okay, thanks. I know we're going to move on to education momentarily, but I do want to ask this question. I'm not sure that you'll know the answer to it. I've never shepherded legislation through Congress. Clearly, this is going to have monetary impact, both of these pieces of legislation, on employers. Are employers involved in the process, in the discussion, in the crafting of this legislation, to an extent that there's an understanding, you know, that they feel satisfaction in at least contributing to the discussion?
Well, that is a big question. I mean, the short answer is employers are well represented in terms of lobbyists who engage with Congress around workplace policy. And frankly, that's one reason why it's hard to pass these bills in Congress. We have seen some states and some cities in recent years pass parallel legislation around work schedules, around access to hours. And definitely it's the case that as these bills move forward and are adopted as law, that absolutely that part of the process is lawmakers coming to a solution that they feel is, you know, politically palatable, which means thinking about the input of different stakeholders and trying to craft a solution that everybody can live with. But the short answer is there's definitely a lot of back and forth and, you know, productive disagreement about what that looks like.
Uphill battle.
Which is why it takes so much time for a bill to get through and become a law.
Absolutely.
All this
Absolutely.
Back and forth. I feel like we could devote the whole show to the topic of gender justice in the employment area, but we do want to move on to education, which I know is another huge area that you're responsible for at the National Women's Law Center. So I'm wondering, Emily, what are the key areas where equal access to education is under attack?
Well, that is another big question, but one of the places that we've been really engaged in recent years is around the rights of survivors of sexual assault and sexual harassment in schools. And unfortunately, a lot of that work has been made more difficult because of steps that the Trump administration took to really weaken the protections that Title IX, the law that prohibits sex discrimination in schools, provides against sexual harassment. The Trump administration and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos adopted Title IX rules that restrict schools' ability to address various types of sexual harassment complaints. Really imposed a much more demanding standard, which is not a great thing because you want schools to be able to address sexual harassment early, before it's a big problem, before students are driven out of classes or out of school altogether by the harassment they're experiencing. The Trump administration also put these really burdensome rules in place on how schools can address complaints of sexual harassment through their disciplinary proceedings. So if you are a student who has been sexually harassed in college and you complain to your school, under these Trump administration rules, the school has to have something that looks a lot like a trial with cross-examination and live testimony of witnesses, and if the witness can't show up in person, the Trump rule said, well, you can't consider anything that witness has ever said in the past, even if it's like a police report or a medical record, that if the person who made the record can't show up and testify, you can't consider that. And there is nothing parallel if you complained about racial harassment, or if you complain that another student punched you in the face, none of those rules apply for any of those sorts of misconduct. So it really sends a deeply disturbing message that allegations of sexual harassment are somehow uniquely unreliable and need this sort of really invasive procedures to test the truth of those allegations that aren't required for literally any other sort of student misconduct investigation. So we have been really engaged in challenging those regulations in court, and we got a partial victory. Court struck down the part of the regulation that said the witness has to show up at the disciplinary hearing and testify. You can't take into account anything the witness has ever said prior to that hearing. And now we are really hopeful that the Biden administration is about to move forward with proposed changes to those rules, and we will be commenting on those proposed changes and really trying to engage folks broadly in support of positive changes that really reorient the conversation to ensuring that students who experience sexual harassment are supported in coming forward and get the help from their schools that they need, rather than being literally cross-examined.
Okay, we're coming up on a break once again, and we will return speaking about education, gender, justice. Thank you.
return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. I'm Tamar Tate. Nina and I are speaking with Emily Martin of the National Women's Law Center. And before the break, we were speaking about education and gender equity. And Emily, you had mentioned the former Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and the changes she had made under the previous administration. And we have a new Secretary of Education now, Dr. Miguel Cardona. And I'm wondering what your organization feels the future holds under him and what his priorities are.
Well, we are definitely happy about the change and hopeful about the opportunities going forward. So I mentioned that we're expecting these proposed changes in Title IX rules around sexual harassment, which is definitely one big thing that Secretary Cardona is leading and spearheading. We also are hopeful and have seen that a priority is ensuring that LGBTQ students aren't experiencing discrimination and harassment in schools. That is a priority of the law centers as well. We are hopeful that these Title IX rules will, in addition to talking about sexual harassment, will make clear that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity are forms of sex discrimination under Title IX and are plainly unlawful. The secretary has said as much, but having it in a rule is a little bit more of a definitive legal statement, and so we are looking forward to that. I also have really appreciated how, under this administration, the Department of Education is really interested in and thoughtful about the intersections of gender justice and racial justice. A lot of the work of the Law Center around the rights of students in recent years has been focused specifically on the experience of black girls, Latinas, and other girls of color, and so one of the things that I think is really promising and interesting is ensuring that when we do work around, say, disparate racial rates in school discipline and what are civil rights protections that ensure that schools are taking steps to protect against students of color experiencing expulsion and suspension at much higher rates than white students, that we are looking specifically at the experience of girls of color and how they experience disparate discipline. Things like dress code enforcement, which often falls more heavily on black girls because their hairstyles are found to be inconsistent with school dress and grooming codes, or just their bodies are more policed and they're more likely to get in trouble for wearing a spaghetti strap shirt than the white girl sitting next to them. So I'm really impressed by the interest and engagement of the Department of Education in those issues under Secretary Cardona, and hope that there is lots more work that the department will be doing focused on gender justice specifically in the years to come.
Yeah, I knew your organization was hoping that an office for gender equity would be established in the Department of Education. Has that taken off? Is there any movement in that direction?
That has not happened, but the Office of Civil Rights, which is a key part of the Department of Education for the enforcement of Title IX, is staffed by a lot of people with deep background in gender justice, and so while there is something to be said for people whose full-time job it is to be thinking about gender. There is also something to be said for ensuring that gender justice is deeply integrated across the Office of Civil Rights work, and in some ways that may help for bringing together the conversations around racial justice and gender justice, bringing together the conversations around LGBTQ students and sex harassment. So I think that there are a lot of different organizational models that can get you to the right place.
Okay, thank you. The we are aware that the United States recently launched a national strategy on gender equity and equality. Is this something that's emanating out of the Civil Rights Department, or is it something different?
Well, that effort has really been spearheaded by the Gender Policy Council in the White House. And the Gender Policy Council is new with this administration, and does sort of reflect that idea that I mentioned before, that it really is a valuable thing to have folks in positions of power whose job it is to focus solely on gender. And they spearheaded this first of its kind